Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, it appears this year's flu epidemic is still of major concern around the country as the number of patients entering clinicians' offices and emergency rooms with flu complications have continued to rise.
And this year's flu season has actually been the deadliest since the swine flu outbreak of 2009, with outbreaks leading to more hospitalizations and deaths than we've seen in a decade. It's put a real strain on the nation's health system. And, you know, Mark, it's not consistent across the country. Still a lot of problems in many states.
Certainly are. And a large sector of the population was not immunized. And the CDC and the U.S. Surgeon General are urging folks who haven't had the flu shot, there's still time.
And this topic brings us to our guest today, Mark. Dr. Tom Frieden is really a giant in the world of public health. He was director of the CDC for 8 years under President Obama. Before that, well known as the health commissioner for the city of New York, he's spearheading an exciting new global initiative now.
Dr. Frieden is now president and CEO of Resolve to Save Lives, a five-year initiative to save 100 million lives globally. He's got some powerful partners in this quest. Really looking forward to having Dr. Frieden back on the show.
And Lori Robertson will stop by, the managing editor of factcheck.org. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Dr. Tom Frieden of Resolve to Save Lives in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. At the winter gathering of the National Governors Association, a lot of talk about healthcare. A bipartisan group of five governors issued a healthcare blueprint for rational approaches moving forward on healthcare policy. Governor Hickenlooper of Colorado and Governor Wolf of Pennsylvania, both Democrats, Governors Sandoval of Nevada and Kasich of Ohio, both Republicans, and Independent Bill Walker of Alaska, they are all asking the federal government to enact legislation that will bolster the insurance markets, increase drug and hospital care price transparency, and support health care access for all Americans. Apple a day may keep the doctor away, but Apple is bringing the doctor in-house. With little fanfare and a newly launched website, Apple has announced it's launching a healthcare company that says it will deliver the world's best healthcare experience to its employees. The tech giant announcing the launch of AC Wellness, starting with two new health clinics that'll serve Apple employees and their families. They have openings listed on the website for primary care clinicians, fitness and wellness experts, and other health providers. The presence of healthcare clinics on the Apple campus serves as yet another hiring perk for employees, but there are also plans to use the clinics as incubators for testing out their suite of health-related products being developed. Apple recently announced a partnership with Stanford Medicine and the telehealth company American Well to launch the first of its kind large-scale Apple Heart Study using tens of thousands of Apple Watch users to gather data on the prevalence of atrial fibrillation. And speaking of AFib, it can lead to stroke and cardiac arrest. And a new study suggests heart attack victims fare much better if a bystander is able to deploy a defibrillator on the spot before emergency help arrives. The new study looked at 2,500 cardiac arrests that happened in public places that were equipped with an automated external defibrillator, or AED. Cardiac patients who were treated on site with the AED immediately were more likely to survive the heart attack and also suffer fewer long-term impairments. Verily, the healthcare unit of Alphabet, formerly part of Google Life Sciences, is reportedly getting into the insurance business. The tech giant in talks with insurers to take on the risk of managing large patient populations using data to ultimately bring costs down. The population health management sector is poised to grow in coming years, especially among payers and players who can demonstrate real cost reduction in managing those populations. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Tom Frieden, President and Chief Executive Officer of Resolve to Save Lives at the nonprofit organization Vital Strategies, dedicated to saving 100 million lives by building a stronger, global public health system. Dr. Frieden served as the director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for 8 years. Before that, he was the commissioner for the City of New York, where he advanced sweeping initiatives to improve public health, including launching the Bloomberg Philanthropies Initiative to reduce tobacco use. Dr. Frieden earned his medical and public health degrees from Columbia University. Dr. Frieden, welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you very much for having me.
You presided over 8 years over the CDC and before that, health commissioner for the City of New York, where you launched initiatives that have limited smoking in public places, tackled trans fats in foods, and confronted infectious disease like HIV. And now you're at the helm of this nonprofit global initiative, Resolve to Save Lives, which seeks to address big health challenges that you've built your career around. And I'm wondering if you could tell our listeners what you hope to bring from your previous experience to this new global venture.
I feel I had an extraordinary privilege of being health commissioner in New York City and director of the CDC to learn from terrific public health doctors, nurses in the U.S. and around the world. And it gave me a particular vantage point to see globally where are the key areas that we're poised to make progress. And we identified really two areas where I feel we can save the most lives with a combination of philanthropic supported effort and government action. The first of those is in preventing heart attacks and strokes. And in that part of the Resolve to Save Lives initiative, we think we can help countries implement programs that will save 100 million lives over the next 30 years. And in the second area, we think it's possible to greatly catalyze more rapid progress preventing epidemics. And if we're successful, we'll look back and we'll see this as an inflection point of a big decrease in heart attacks and strokes and a big decrease in the risk of epidemics. And our approach at Resolve is to have simple, scalable, fast interventions that will be able to make a difference.
So, Dr. Frieden, you're being supported by some very high-profile players in the global health arena, certainly the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, Bloomberg Philanthropies, and, of course, the World Health Organization, World Bank, and the CDC. Tell us a little bit about how these partner organizations are working together with Vital Strategies to help you meet the goals that you've laid out in Resolve to Save Lives.
We're so fortunate to have very generous donations of $225 million over 5 years from Bloomberg Philanthropies, the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Resolve to Save Lives is an initiative of an organization called Vital Strategies. It has offices in more than 60 countries, including more than 100 staff who are working side by side in countries around the world, including the World Health Organization, the World Bank, the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, where there's an urgent need and no available resources to provide the support that's needed.
You know, your Resolve to Save Lives is focusing on two key areas of public health. And you've tackled these public health issues quite successfully with programs such as your smoking ban and trans fat ban in New York City and confronted epidemics such as HIV and more recently Ebola. And I'm wondering if you could talk about some of the important public health campaigns you've undertaken, what you've learned from them, and the challenges of scaling up some of those early successes.
What makes for success in global health is having three fundamental bases covered of technical rigor, operational excellence, and political will. It's so important that there's what I refer to as a technical package of high-impact interventions that, when implemented, will make a really big difference. On the operational side, it means good management. We've seen that in tuberculosis control, where policies from the World Health Organization helped countries establish its accountability for every single patient diagnosed. What is their outcome? And also political will, making the policy initiative to tax tobacco and soda. These are decisions that have life and death consequences, whether it's been making New York City smoke-free or working with communities throughout West Africa to stop the Ebola epidemic. You have to have those three components.
Certainly, one of the greatest public health interventions of the past century has been the development of our vaccines. Their life-saving and disease-preventing evidence is irrefutable, but we've, in the front lines in community health, seen a resurgence of preventable diseases like measles and pertussis or whooping cough. And this year, and the flu epidemic has been so harsh, we're seeing pediatric deaths that we haven't seen in years, but the vaccine was only administered to about half of the country's population, and it's still an incredibly important hedge against contracting the flu. Maybe you could talk with us a little bit about the challenge of getting people to comply with vaccines.
Vaccines are truly a public health miracle. They have saved literally hundreds of millions of lives, eradicated smallpox, brought polio to the brink of eradication, saved many millions of lives from measles. What happens as those diseases get less common is that people become less interested in getting vaccinated. In Africa, there's been a wonderful program which the Gates Foundation, a group called PATH, and others have been central to creating a vaccine for meningitis. That vaccine is available for less than $1 a dose. It's very effective, and it's given to people up to age 29. So that's usually a population that's quite hard to reach. It's much easier to vaccinate kids. And yet the vaccine rates in that campaign were more than 90%. And the reason for that was people see meningitis. Mm-hmm. In some ways, vaccines have been a victim of their own success.
Right.
Because people don't see those diseases everywhere, they may be less interested in getting a vaccine. The flu vaccine, even in a good year, isn't nearly as effective as we'd like. It's about 60% effective. This year, it looks like it's going to be somewhere in the 15 to 25% effective range, which is nowhere near what we'd like. But it's the best option. 20%, after all, is a lot better than 0%.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there's a lot of interest in a universal flu vaccine. It's probably a decade or decades away. This year, we could increase investment in understanding which vaccines work better. And any one of those three vaccines is going to be better. But only actual data will show. And mm-hmm. the Centers for Disease Control is the best organization to study which of those vaccines works best, but doesn't have the relatively modest resources that would allow it to figure that out. It's sometimes frustrating and sometimes ironic that we may be willing to invest in a very important effort. It's great that Congress is putting billions of dollars into that, but for $10 or $20 million, they may be able to get the current vaccine very effective for people within a couple of years.
We're speaking today with Dr. Tom Frieden, President and Chief Executive Officer of Resolve to Save Lives, a five-year initiative at the nonprofit organization Vital Strategies. Dr. Frieden, you say that we are at a tipping point globally and you expect a tsunami of non-communicable diseases. I wonder if you could tell our listeners what has you most concerned about those looming health threats.
Two areas that I'm most concerned about are the two areas we're focusing on at Resolve: cardiovascular disease and epidemics. In terms of cardiovascular disease, the leading cause of death in the world, it causes one out of three deaths, and most of them are preventable. 10 million people a year are killed by high blood pressure. That's as many as are killed by all infectious diseases combined. Globally, about 1.4 billion people have high blood pressure, but only 10 or 15% of them have it under control. And treatment can be scaled up, but what's happening now is that blood pressure goes untreated, and all over Africa and other parts of low and middle-income countries, you're having an epidemic of strokes, heart attacks that are causing personal tragedies. We think there are clear wins to be had in cardiovascular prevention, as there are in epidemic prevention. And if we fail to do that, the cost will be in millions of lives and billions or even trillions of dollars in avoidable health and societal costs.
You spent 8 years at the helm of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention under President Obama. The current administration has been taking a different approach. There's been funding cuts to many key health programs and a significant cut to the CDC's budget. Share your thoughts on the progress that you were able to make during your tenure and in this very difficult couple of weeks that we've experienced with another mass shooting. Your thoughts about the restriction on funding to study gun violence specifically.
Let me start with the 8 years that I had the privilege to lead CDC. We left America stronger and healthier, and we did that through strengthening systems to find and stop health threats in this country and to improve our ability to protect this country from threats that might arise from other countries. The proposal of the current administration for the CDC's budget for the next budget year would bring the CDC budget down to its lowest level in 15 years. It would be more than a 20% cut. It would also really harm CDC's ability to prevent heart attacks, strokes, and cancer by doing something called block granting and cutting those programs. That's just very bad government. It doesn't allow the CDC to support states in running effective programs, and it makes it easier for those programs to be cut in the future, as in fact the administration is proposing in this year to cut the block grant. It also would cut a very important program that helps state and municipal health departments find and stop threats in schools, in hospitals. It's a very successful program that has stopped outbreaks of drug-resistant bacteria, and it would be ended under the administration's proposal. And the proposal would cut by two-thirds CDC's forward-deployed doctors, epidemiologists, who are working around the world to help other countries stop diseases there so we don't have to fight them here. And that would make Americans less safe. I hear from both houses of Congress strong support for CDC. So I'm hopeful that when the 18 budget and the 19 budget are finalized, the administration's proposals will not come to pass. Your second question is about coverage under the Affordable Care Act. It is absolutely the case that the Affordable Care Act resulted in more than 20 million people having access to health insurance and health coverage who didn't have it before. And that saves lives. We are spending more than any other rich country on healthcare, and we're getting worse health outcomes. I hope there can be a bipartisan approach to saying, what are some things that we can do in healthcare that will actually help us get more value for the dollars we put in and improve the health status of this country so we stop being a laggard in health status? In terms of gun violence, I've been deeply moved by what some of the students of the most recent shooting have spoken out about. And the CDC doesn't advocate for policy. The CDC provides data on what the science shows. Every year we ask Congress for $10 million to do research on gun violence, and every year Congress declined to provide those resources. But we were able to support state governments in more than 40 states to study what's happening really far too often. We have rates that are many, many, many times higher than any other upper-income country.
You know, Dr. Frieden, I was thinking earlier, as you were saying, that you were inspired by physicians and scientists and the work that you were doing. And, you know, you're taking on a challenge about global health. Who's inspiring you, and who's inspiring that next generation of young people to get engaged in these public health initiatives?
For me personally, my father was the biggest influence on my life. And he said very simply, you got to help the people. And I've tried to structure my career to save as many lives as possible. I've been deeply inspired by leaders in public health like Bill Foege, who led the efforts to eradicate smallpox, and rigorous science, excellent management, eloquence, and listening to what's really happening on the front lines. Many of us in public health get most inspired when we see what's happening on the front lines, whether it's the public health nurse who was the person who sounded the alarm with this horrific outbreak of HIV related to opiate use in Indiana. Mm-hmm. That individual saved hundreds of lives by being alert. Or the patients who come to us and tell us what either the disease means or the tragedy means. I became quite close to Terry, who was one of our spokespeople for tips from former smokers at CDC. And I was just thinking about her. She was a wonderful woman who wanted to share her history. She had started smoking as a teenager in North Carolina, picking tobacco, and she developed cancer in her 40s, died in her 50s. And by sharing her story, she probably saved more lives than most doctors will in their entire career.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Tom Frieden, President and Chief Executive Officer of Resolve to Save Lives, a five-year initiative at the nonprofit organization Vital Strategies, dedicated to saving 100 million lives by building a stronger global public health system. You can learn more about their work by going to resolvetosavelives.org or follow them on Twitter at ResolveTSL and also at Dr. Frieden. Dr. Frieden, we thank you so much for your contribution to public health and for joining us once again on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
The February 14th deadly mass shooting at a high school in Parkland, Florida, has brought the public health issue of guns to the fore. One topic of discussion is background checks. Results of a national survey published in 2017 show that 13% of U.S. gun owners who purchased a firearm in the past 2 years did so without a background check. Senator Bernie Sanders was wrong when he recently said that the figure was 3 times as high. Sanders was referring to a statistic based on a nearly 24-year-old survey when he told NBC News' Chuck Todd on February 18th, quote, 40% of the guns in this country are sold without any background checks. In January 2017, the Annals of Internal Medicine published the results of a study on firearm acquisitions authored by researchers at Northeastern University and Harvard. It concluded that, quote, 22% of current U.S. gun owners who acquired a firearm within the past 2 years did so without a background check. Just 13% of those who were sold a gun, as Sanders said, in the previous 2 years did not have a background check, according to the data. The findings were based on an online survey of 1,613 adult gun owners in 2015. The older 40% figure had been questionable before. That 1994 survey asked whether participants, quote, acquired this gun from a licensed firearm dealer. And 64.3% answered yes or probably was slash think so, leaving about 40% who said they didn't acquire the gun from a licensed dealer. But the question wasn't specifically about background checks. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. When Wichita, Kansas nurse practitioner Michael Warzewski learned of the harsh and often fatal conditions that expectant mothers endure in sub-Saharan Africa, all because they live too far from a medical clinic, he thought there had to be a way to fill that need. He came up with a solution. Clinic in a can, transforming shipping containers into fully equipped mobile clinics and operating rooms that can be shipped anywhere in the world where there is a need.
When you walk in the inside, you will believe or think that you're inside your doctor's office or inside the clinical environment. They look exactly the same.
Warzewski learned from his early iterations that gas-powered generators could be problematic in low-resource areas and switched all of his portable clinics to solar power, which he says was a game-changer.
Solar power has become the cornerstone of how we re-engineered how we power our clinics so that now every piece of equipment, we can run it off of 500 watts of electricity, which means 6 solar panels and 8 batteries is enough to run a clinic for 18 hours.
Since its founding a decade ago, clinics in a can have been delivered to war-torn Sudan, to earthquake-ravaged Haiti, and more recently to Santa Rosa, California, an area decimated by the wildfires that also destroyed the main community health center there.
These are converted shipping containers that arrive fully equipped as a medical exam room.
Santa Rosa Community Health Center CEO Naomi Fuchs says that the portable clinic was a godsend for her providers. The roughly 120 square feet shipping container clinics are designed to support workflow and to become a permanent fixture in low resource areas.
A containerized clinic is something that's a turnkey. It's all built here in the United States. We equip it with the best equipment, and we ship it as a completed project that once on the ground, within 20, 30 minutes, it's ready to be used.
Clinic in a can, a professionally outfitted shipping container, fully equipped with medical and surgical equipment, providing quality, state-of-the-art medical facilities in a low-resource area. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.